You're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast, making death and dying something we can all talk about.
Hello and welcome to our Art of Dying Well podcast. And we have a really interesting topic today because we're going to talk about pets and animals and bereavement, which is an important subject, but one we've not talked about. We talk about humans all the time, but we have not talked about animals. Now, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Daniela Dos Santos, who's a junior vice president of the British Veterinary Association. Daniela, is that right?
That is.
Great. Now, obviously you're a vet. Tell us what inspired you to become a vet, first of all.
So my family has no scientific background, but I had a goldfish when I was a kid that one evening was swimming upside down in its bowl, and I forced my poor mother to spend the whole evening just poking it, making sure it was still alive in the morning. And when it was, I promised myself that I didn't want to see another animal suffer like that, and the rest is history.
It's funny because I sort of read a bit about you on LinkedIn as well, and you're clearly as interested in people as animals, would that be fair to say? Is it a sociable job being a vet?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that I like people and animals equally, and I think a huge part of my job that I enjoy is getting to know people, getting to form relationships with them. Of course, I'm there to look after their pets, but they are there to look after their pets, and if we can work together, the welfare of the animal is better served.
We're quite often, certainly with clinicians and doctors, nurses, we talk about the sort of bedside manner, the accompaniment, the breaking bad news. Now, that unfortunately must be an aspect of the job that you have to do quite a lot. Do you receive any training for that interaction with people when you're giving them the worst news?
So, generally speaking, when you're in college, you'll get your communications training and taught how to speak to people and body language and things like that. And some of it will come with experience. You know, the first time you have to break that news to an owner, whatever situation you're in, is pretty difficult. And there are certain training courses out there that you can also go on to help further your knowledge and your understanding and how you can assist people through a difficult time.
And I guess everyone's different, though. There's no rule book with this, is there?
Absolutely not. Everyone's different, and every animal's different as well. And that often impacts on the situation you're in. If you have a proactive situation where an animal's diagnosed with something terminal, where it's been in palliative care, or there's been some time for the owner to get their head around it, then often you can have these discussions earlier on. If you're in a situation, for example, a road traffic accident, where there really isn't anything you can do, that's often much harder. You know, you could often be dealing with a much younger animal where the thought of losing their pet just hasn't crossed their mind, and all of a sudden they're confronted with a situation where there's no other option. So it is always a difficult situation, but it changes depending on the situation, the animal and the person involved as well.
And those of us that have had pets, we sort of have that personal experience where you'll see where I'm going with this. But I think that, you know, we can sometimes treat animals like humans, can't we? We can grieve in the same way. We can have them as our best friend in the same way. We can rely on them in the same way. Is that something that you see all the time?
Absolutely. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that the grief someone goes through when they lose a pet is akin to that of losing a family member. And it depends on your personal situation as to how you deal with that grief. You know, if it's an elderly person and their sole companion is their cat and they might go weeks without seeing another human being, then there is a very, very strong bond there. Equally, if you have a small child who doesn't need their imaginary friend because their little dog will follow them around and play games, then there's a different bond there. I wouldn't underestimate the working dog either. So, you know, when you have a handler that is working day in, day out with that dog, they form an incredibly close bond. And even though there is not always that, you know, Fluffy sits on the bed with me, there is a different level of bond there, and I think we have to tailor everything to the situation.
Well, frankly, it's a relationship, isn't it?
So absolutely.
Not easily broken.
No, well, until I get involved, but yes. No, not easily broken, and I think it's one of the hardest parts of our job is to, in the moment, try and figure out what's right for that person and that animal standing in front of us.
Well, I mean, it must be nice to talk about helping pets, making them better. That's not so much the thrust of this, unfortunately. But in terms of children, because this was our focus, actually, to talk about bereavement and children. I rather incorrectly, off mic, prior to this, thought that with the younger children, you might have to use so-called gentle language, like, I'm going to have to put Fluffy to sleep, or something like that. And you corrected me very quickly, didn't you?
So the way you deal with these things very much depends on the age of the child. But if you start to think about children who are maybe 2, 3, 4, they take words literally. So to them, Fluffy going to sleep means Fluffy's going to come back, and it actually often causes an undue amount of anxiety and stress for that child. And often the younger ones, they don't truly have a concept of death, and so their way of grieving is not the same as, say, a 10, 11, 12 year old. So for the very young, actually the literal words and honesty is the best course of action. In fact, honesty for all children is the best way to approach this.
And how about the teenagers? Again, we talked about possibly one might have a child who isn't communicating very well with parents, siblings, adults, yet will take some solace in having that relationship where perhaps they can unload their problems and feelings to a dog or an animal. So how do you deal with them in that age bracket?
So by that age, they understand. They understand exactly what's going on. And sometimes I have to take the lead from the parent. You know, they are the ones there making the decisions. But if the teenager, let's say a 13, 14-year-old, is in the room, it's really important that I acknowledge they're there and I speak directly to them and I ask if they have any questions. I explain the process. I always, regardless of whether we're talking about adults or children here, I always give the option of whether they'd like to stay till the end. And I make it very, very clear that there's no right or wrong answer.
So it's not a case of no children in here?
No. So for the younger ones, I'd say maybe for the sort of 5, 6, 7-year-olds, I think that becomes a parental choice. In some ways, them being present allows them to understand fully what's going on. But every child matures at a different rate. And to suggest that all 10-year-olds can watch this isn't entirely appropriate. So back to the teenagers, you know, I will have a discussion and you'll often find that you say, would you like to be present? And they just can't articulate. And sometimes the conversation will go, well, do you want to know what will happen? And I will discuss and the fact that actually it is a peaceful process and so on. And exactly what will happen, what to expect, timeframes. And sometimes they absolutely want to stay there. And if they understand what's coming, you know, the teenagers say, no, I want to hold on to my cat until the last minute. Some, they just want to remember their cat or their pet as it was, and they don't want to see that last moment.
And do you ever get parents or adults saying, Daniela, I don't know what to say to my child. What can I say? How can I either console them or help them through this? What would you tend to say then?
I would say every child's different. And so whilst I can give advice based on my experiences, I don't know the individual child. I don't know their circumstances. I don't know the levels of maturity. And so my overriding advice is always be honest. It isn't fair to a child if you know that animal is not coming home to go to the vet and come back without the dog. Yeah. Actually, that child needs to grieve, and the process of grieving starts from the point at which the decision's been made. So honesty. I do, if they feel it's appropriate, offer to explain the situation myself. Some parents take me up on it, some don't. I think it very much depends on the parent-child relationship. Some parents just find it very difficult to have that conversation, whereas others who have a more open relationship with their children will actually do the talking with me in the background and then revert to me if there are any questions that the child will ask that they can't answer.
Now, often with humans, obviously, we talk about palliative care and, you know, in those advanced stages, looking after the person as calmly, carefully and as pain-free as possible. Can you make it pain-free with animals as they're dying?
Yes, most of the time. So I think in veterinary medicine, we are in a privileged position that we have the choice to offer the owner to end suffering. And so I think it isn't directly comparable to end of life in the human. Mm-hmm. I think that the situations are different. And so if you have a terminal diagnosis in an animal, let's choose something like kidney failure, for example, which is known about and therefore we have been managing or treating for a period of time, then often the suffering is minimised in that sort of situation because the owner will realise the animal is slowing down and so on. For painful conditions, certain types of cancers and things like that, then obviously we will dispense pain relief and so on to make things as comfortable as possible. We are not in the position that human medics are in terms of sedatives and things like that. But I have a very frank discussion with the owners and I always say to them, you would rather say goodbye a day too soon than a day too late, because I can guarantee you will never forgive yourself for that one day too late. And I've never had an owner say it was too soon, but I've had plenty of owners say it was too late. So again, it's about that preparatory dialogue that you need to have. So you get that diagnosis where you know actually there isn't going to be a good outcome here. And you have that honest and frank discussion. had a conversation just last week, young cat, diagnosed with a very large abdominal tumour, inoperable. The owner asked me that day, honestly, do I need to say goodbye now? And actually, even though that animal had a tumour, the animal was comfortable. And I said, no, you don't. And we had a long and frank discussion about what the process would be at the end, her choices. And so when the day came, she's just going to say goodbye. She doesn't need to worry about all the other bits and pieces. I think we're in a privileged position compared to medics that we can end suffering, but I don't think it's directly comparable.
So I'm not saying there's a typical death or a typical terminal illness in an animal, but just talk us through the process when somebody who's probably relatively ignorant of that process comes in a bit of a state with the animal, maybe with a child as well.
Yeah.
How do you explain what's about to happen?
So I think the simplest way for me to explain it is that it's an overdose of anaesthetic. It's an overdose of anaesthetic that doesn't hurt, and all the animal feels is that they're going to go to sleep, and they get sleepy, and then that's the end. The whole process, though, it's really important to explain, particularly if people are distressed or not expecting it, or if children are present. The whole process is actually quite a quick process, and once you start injecting the drug, it's all over in a matter of seconds to minutes, depending on the animal, the disease they're in for, and so on. And so it's really important that we warn the owners, because actually if they're expecting this to take 5 or 10 minutes, and a minute later I say to them, I'm really sorry, they've gone, that's a really traumatic experience for them. So I always explain it as an overdose of anaesthetic that is very quick, and your goodbyes have to have been said before I start, so that they're not caught off guard. Down to the finer details depends on the individual situation. So let's say you've got an agitated cat or dog, we will give a sedation first, so it would just be a little injection, and the animal will be unconscious. They won't have passed away. They won't be aware of us, you know, trying to get IV catheters in or anything like that. And that's particularly in my experience, for example, I will use it for an old arthritic cat that doesn't like its elbows being held or something like that. And actually, it's much nicer at the end to give them a little bit of a sedation, and then the final moments are quite peaceful. You have to discuss, you know, the things about muscle relaxing and urination and defecation, and sometimes they take what looks like a last gasp. That particular one is quite difficult to have that conversation. So it's agonal breathing, but to a person standing there with their beloved pet, it looks like a last gasp. And I always say it before I start, they may take what looks like a last breath, but they are not here. This is purely a neurological reflex. And I remember as a very young vet having not explained that to someone, and they were there with their dog, and about 2 minutes later, this breath came out of nowhere. And the owner was so traumatised that I realised I was taking for granted that they would expect to see that. So yeah, whether it's proactive, reactive, I will explain the whole thing. Generally, it's quick. You need to be ready to and have said your goodbyes. And then I will say the other bits and pieces, but I won't put too much focus on it. I always give them time as well, if possible. So if it's an emergency situation, that's different. But I'll always say, do you want a bit more time? There's no pressure. I will go away. I will leave them. It is led by the owner with my advice behind it.
And how about you personally? I mean, your heart must soar if you can do, you know, can heal or make more healthy an animal that looks like you might be losing. I'm sure that's a huge positive. But how do you cope when it's pretty obvious that no matter all the training, all the expertise and love and care, you can't do so much? Do you yourself feel down? Is it a difficult thing to deal with?
It's a privilege to be able to ensure an animal has a good death. Is how I feel about it. Because if you look at certain diseases, the end was never going to be nice. In most cases, you're talking about elderly animals. You know, they've had a good life, and actually I console myself in the way that they've had a good life, they'll have a good death. But don't get me wrong, there are situations that are tough, and people expect a professional to be exactly that professional, but professionals do cry as well. And I've had cases of a very young dog treated for a chronic condition that we just couldn't get under control, and the time came that the owners decided that they couldn't do this to the dog anymore. And as I was euthanizing the dog, I cried with the owners. When they left, I sobbed, and I sobbed over this dog's body for about half an hour. And just because we have that privilege doesn't mean we don't feel it and that we're immune to it. We are lucky to be able to end suffering, but with it comes the care and the compassion. And every so often, it comes out in front of the owner. And I really don't think that's a bad thing. They realise you care. They realise it's not just you're injecting and this is part of your job. You know, this is a life that you're ending, but you're ending in a dignified way.
Yeah. And in terms of, I don't want to be too clinical, in terms of post-death of an animal, what happens to the body? Is that a consultative thing, or is, tell me what happens there?
So it is a consultative thing. Either we've discussed it before, if it's a preemptive decision, or we've discussed it on the day. And generally speaking, there are three options. So in some cases, pets can go home and be buried at home. If you're in an inner city, that's a bit harder. But generally speaking, there is always that option. And then cremation is the other option. And the owners can choose whether or not they'd like their animal individually cremated and returned to them. And there are various different types of caskets and urns and so on that they can come back in to suit their different wants and needs. Some practices will offer things such as fur clippings and paw prints as mementos. So those are generally speaking the three options you get.
And going back to children, I know you spoke to me before we recorded this again about having a sort of, you know, a box that can be decorated and so forth. So I was thinking that there'd be all this grief and then the time would come. And I didn't really think about that next step. But that can bring solace as well, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. And that is part of the grieving process. So if it's a preemptive situation, for example, and of course this is all dependent on the child's age and so on. But, you know, if it's a preemptive situation, a scrapbook to keep all your memories and to put in those last pictures, and that will help. I've had cases where the pet has gone home to be buried and we've sent it in a little cardboard casket and the child has drawn pictures and memories and written words and in some situation prayers, because that's their religious beliefs. And that really has helped the child come to terms with the loss. But again, that's not it. You know, parents should be prepared to have these conversations and the questions and, oh, do you remember when Fluffy did this and that? It doesn't just stop because they're not there anymore.
And then a little bit beyond that, two questions. The first one, again, you might have a number of answers to this, but when should and how should one replace the animal? Maybe replace is the key word, because you shouldn't do that. When should you get another pet, and what is the thinking behind, you know, moving on from your beloved pet?
I don't think there's an answer for that question, is the honest answer. So if you've ever had a pet yourself, you know you can never replace them. You can get another dog, or you can get another cat. You can't get another Rover or Fluffy or anything like that. It is very, very much a personal decision. And I think it's important that grieving owners don't feel that there's a right way to deal with it. In some cases, owners don't like having an empty house, and actually getting another pet comes quite quickly. For others, the grief is so profound that they just can't face the thought of another animal in the same space. And I think that's very much an individual decision.
Do you find that owners can actually get depressed after the death of an animal?
It's grief. It's grief like losing a human member of your family. Absolutely. There are pet bereavement counsellors out there, and I think it's really important that we don't underestimate the level of grief. We're talking about animals that are there day in, day out. They don't judge. They don't care how much money you earn or the shoes you're wearing. They don't care if you haven't brushed your hair or your teeth in 3 days. They don't judge, and they are there through thick and thin. You can never replace them, and we have to accept that grief takes time, and that varies from person to person.
Do you think there's a sort of, and I feel this a bit sometimes, that there's a train of thought amongst pet owners versus those that either haven't got pets or have never had a pet, whereby they feel a bit guilty for grieving over an animal, rather than, you know, when they look at a friend who's maybe lost a brother to cancer or whatever else? Do you think there's that sort of human animal disconnect where people feel a bit self-conscious about loving an animal so much?
I don't think so. I've never come across it that way. I've come across it the other way, where people that have never owned an animal don't understand why their friend is so upset over the loss of a dog. It's just a dog. It's just a smelly dog. Why are you so upset? Why are you crying? This was 2 days ago. Why is it such an issue? So I think it's actually more the other way. People who have not owned pets don't understand the grief people are going through.
Now, I can tell, obviously, that you're very passionate about animals and people, which is marvellous. But Would you say that most vets, if you had questions, maybe you didn't even have a sick animal at the time, but your child or a child you look after has given you 100,000 questions, is it possible to go to your vet or phone up your vet and say, look, my head is I don't know what to say, I'm not an expert, can you help me with some of these questions?
Absolutely. If you have any questions, any concerns, anything you're not sure about, just pick up the phone and call the practice. If there's not someone available, they'll get someone to call you back. It will either be the vet or the vet nurse, and they will take their time. This is such an important part of the family's life and the animal's life that we want it to be as peaceful and as respectful as possible and as stress-free. These situations are never going to be stress-free. But absolutely, pick up the phone and a vet or a vet nurse will absolutely go through all of it with you.
Well, Daniela, thank you so much. You live about 100 miles away from me, but if God forbid, my wonderful dog Sassy gets sick, I'm coming your way.
I'm sure your local vet would be just as fine to do it.
Daniela, thank you.
Thank you.
The quite marvellous Daniela Dos Santos there, a lover of both animals and humans. Great guest. And I'd say a brilliant advocate for our veterinary surgeons. Now, I can drop a useful link in at this point. Daniela, as you've just heard, is a junior vice president of the British Veterinary Association. So if you want to find out a little bit more, perhaps download some leaflets, visit www.bva-awf.org.uk, bva-awf.org.uk, or on Twitter at @awf_vets. Right, there you go. Okay, people, it's that time in the podcast for
Death Chatter. It's just a chat about death.
Well, we like to do things a little bit differently. Unfortunately, I have two excellent new contributors to our Art of Dying Well podcasts, and obviously you can't see them, so you're going to have to identify yourselves. On my right?
Sophie Reed.
Lovely. And opposite me?
Daniela Ballard.
Right, so we are talking about the death of pets, and I just wondered, first of all, I'm going to ask a weird question. Do you think sometimes when pets die, we sort of, because they're not human, we're not allowed to grieve when pets die, or do you think that's rubbish?
Yeah, I do think you're kind of not allowed to grieve, because it's kind of like, oh yeah, it's just a pet. It's not like a real person. Mm. But you do have a connection with your pet, a connection that sometimes you don't have with a family member or a human.
Now, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but off mic, Sophie, you did say that you would grieve harder at the death of your cats than maybe some family members.
Yeah.
Controversial.
Yeah, I would, yeah. Because I think of how much my cats have gone through with me, different emotions. Like, they were there when I got into uni. They were there when I left for uni.
Yeah.
They were there when I left for second year. I would, because they are... is such an integral part of my life than what other family members that should be considered close family are in my life.
And Daniela, how close are you to your animals?
I'm very close to my animals. I think I would grieve just as much if a human died than, but I am just as affected. My first reaction probably slightly more, and I think there is this stigma around where people say, oh, calm down, like it's a cat, it's all right, it's not a human, there's no need for you to cry this much, or there's no need for you to be this affected, like, oh, you'll get over it, but then if it was a human, it would be, oh, they're, like, it will all be okay, and I know why there's a difference, but I wouldn't necessarily agree with it, because at the end of the day, if you have a pet in your life, they're just as important to you and they're an integral part of your life and your kind of routine, just as a human would be.
So. And staying with you, Daniela, when you were young, tell us about how you felt when those pets close to you died.
I was a broken human for a while. It was quite an odd situation. I think I said I was about 12. And it was Easter, and I was studying. I was doing a history project on like death and diseases, and kind of the history of treatment for that kind of stuff. So I was already in kind of a deep and kind of a dark place, looking at all of this kind of gruesome stuff. And my cat Pixie had been with me all of my life, so she was very, very old. She was like 100 or over 100 in cat years. And we took her to the vet, and the vet said, you know, you're going to have to think about putting her down this week. So we agreed that we'd put her down on the Friday, and this was Monday. So not only did I have to come to terms with that by the end of this week, my beloved cat would be dead, and it would be because we took her to the vet, and we, you know, we let them kill her. But unfortunately, on the Wednesday, I was doing work in the kitchen, and my cat was lying on her favourite, like, picnic blanket, because it was nice and soft. And she had a seizure in front of me, like full convulsing seizure. She couldn't breathe or anything. And I screamed for my mum, and my mum came running in with my sisters. My sisters are younger than me, so all three of us were absolutely distraught. My mum turns around and goes, "Stop screaming! The cat's already having a heart attack. There's no need for you to scream, because that's not going to make it any better." So I take them outside, and we're like absolutely broken. My dad comes home and is like holding her and like helping my mum, and all three of us are convinced that she's still alive, so we're like, "Don't bury her alive, like she's moving," and she wasn't moving. We were just so upset that we could physically see her tail moving, but actually no, she had died. And well, because of that, the way we basically told our parents she had to be buried in the blanket because it would be warm and comfortable. And we buried her. It was Easter Sunday, I think we buried her. So it makes me laugh, okay, chuckle now, because it's like, oh, how apt on Easter Sunday that my cat would be buried. And now we made a little cross for her, and we put that on there. And now there's a tree that kind of grows where she's buried. Now, so I go outside sometimes. I'm like, oh, you're buried there, and you have been for many years. So yeah, for about 2 weeks afterwards, every night I was crying because I couldn't quite believe that my cat had died. And we had in that time we had no other pets in the house either, so it was really, really quiet with just the five of us. And you wouldn't usually think that, because it was three very young girls and we're quite a kind of loud family, but it really does make a difference when you haven't got a pet around. So what my parents did was, about a week before, we got like a giant donut maker, so they made us, like, all three of us make a giant donut each, and then we all dedicated it to our cat and then spent about a month eating the donuts. And that's kind of what my parents did, was that they were really brutally honest with us and sat us down, and we all kind of had a chat about it and talked about our feelings, but at the same time they gave us food and sweets to make us feel better. And I think that's okay. I think it's important that if it does happen, that if you feel sad or you want to grieve, then do, because I don't think it's healthy to kind of keep it all in, no matter if it is a cat. Like, if it's a cat, if it's a dog, or if it is a human, they matter equally. It depends on how close you were to them. So, and particularly with children, do what makes them happy. So if they like playing with a particular toy or watching a particular TV show, allow them to do that.
With that in mind, do you think that your parents handled it well?
I think they did, yeah. I think they gave us a chance to talk about our feelings, and they also told us the truth, but in a way that we were able to understand, because I was about 12, so my sisters were about 10 and under. So we were all very young and kind of very naive, so we were all a bit confused. They also, you know, we had a chat about like where she'd gone, where the cat was going, and that we had this whole thing of that, because I had past family members I don't remember dying, but we had this thing of, oh, Nan will look after the cat for you, like it'll all be okay. And then after that, yeah, we kind of just all ate food and watched TV together, and it was kind of nice. We took a couple of days out where we did nothing, but just they allowed us that time to do what we wanted to do. So there was no kind of, oh, it's a cat, get over it. It was, are you sad? Okay, that's fine. Come here and have a hug and you get over it eventually. And it did take some time, but I think having that time helped me get over it quickly, because I didn't feel like I had to hide it. I was allowed to feel, and that helped, I think.
And Sophie, how about your experiences of animal death or how you feel about an animal?
Yeah, I have lost my first pet when I was about 11 years old. And I hadn't dealt with death at all. My grandmother died when I was really young, so I didn't remember that at all. So I didn't really know how to process it. I didn't really know about how to process my grief. And I feel like my mum did handle it very well, with the fact that she just let life carry on. She just didn't make it change out of my routine. I'm very very stick to a routine type of person. And I went to my singing lesson the day after. I just sang like a song more dedicated to her, just to let it all out. I'm a musical theatre person, just to focus all of my emotion into that, which was really nice. But animals have their different personalities. Like, my cats now have two completely different personalities, and they are part of the family, and I don't think you can replace that personality. I don't think, with my younger cat, Eliza, I don't think I could get another cat with that type of personality. So it is like losing a person.
Eugenia, you made a very interesting point before we started this death chatter, which I hadn't thought of personally, but you were saying, I think quite rightly, that actually it's probably even harder if a pet goes missing.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
My second cat, Tinkerbell, she went missing. And to this day, we don't know what's happened to her. And I feel that's worse for me. Like, did she die? Did she have a good life? Did she find another family? Did they love her as much as we did? But with Safi, it was, okay, she's dead. She's lived a life. We loved her. It is that not knowing that was horrible. And that you do still hold on to that tiny little bit of hope that she'll come back. Even now, I'm like, maybe she'll come back. I'll see a cat that looks like her, and I'm like, Tinkerbell. But
it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like a sort of more permanent state of grief because you don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Daniela, would you say your early experiences of the death of pets were somewhat similar to Sophie, in that actually teaches you something about death? Might be your first experience or first sort of cognitive experience with death, or is that less so with you?
Yeah, I think it definitely taught me things. I think it definitely taught me that it is okay to feel, it is okay to grieve, but I also learned that everyone grieves differently, and I learned that was okay, and to accept any way of grief, even if you don't grieve that way, and also keep kind of communication with people and surround yourself with people, will pick you up, but also can just will give you a hug when you need it, and tell people if you're not okay, just so that they're aware as well. Because even if it is like a death of a pet or death of a person, you should never go through it alone, because it is awful. But I also did learn that it does get better. It might take a week, it might take a year. Because I think for me, I had that really intense kind of 3 weeks afterwards where I was crying every night and like whatever. But then even a year later, when it came to the anniversary, I broke down again. And it took me by surprise, because I was like, oh, I thought I was over this. You know, I thought I'd finished the process, but apparently I hadn't. I think once I got past that first year, I was like, okay, I can lay you to rest now. You're okay, I'm getting better. But I think you just need to be aware that everyone's different, and that's okay, and that doesn't make you bad, it doesn't make you any better, it's just the way it is, I guess.
And without necessarily foisting children upon you at your young age, what would you say to a child who, you know, was going through that similar experience you were going through at 11? How would you approach it in terms of helping them cope with their grief?
Oh, I don't know. I have cousins that age, and they've just had to go through their dog almost dying. And it was like they've had him since he was a little puppy when they were younger. And trying to approach that to a child is very difficult when they're old enough to understand what's happening, because they have known death in their family to the point where they don't understand the massive impact of it. It's very difficult. It's very something that you do need to approach very cautiously and almost let them figure out how to deal with their grief.
Do you think there's a sliding scale? I.e., because we've talked about dogs, we've talked about cats, but is there a sort of sliding scale of grief here? Like, if your goldfish dies, are you upset? If your hamster dies? Is it? I'm not saying the bigger the animal, the more grief you feel, although that might be true. Do you think there is a sliding scale? Would you grieve less over a goldfish?
I was gutted when my hamster died. We had it for 2 years. You know, like, hamsters are known for literally, like, staying alive for 2 years and then dying, but I wasn't expecting it. It was like 2 days after my birthday. I was gutted.
So it's more the relationship you have with that animal rather than the type of animal.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
If you've got a great relationship with your goldfish, be distraught when he dies.
But then maybe if your dog could talk and hug you, that'd be even worse, do you reckon?
Yeah, I think that would also be very odd.
It would be odd.
It would be odd. It would be odd. But it would be quite similar to all the Disney shows that currently exist, so I wouldn't...
Let's turn it on its head a little bit before we conclude. There's definitely something to be said about animals accompanying us when we're sick, isn't there? How do you look at that relationship? Do you think it's a comfort, an accompaniment, something positive if you yourself are feeling sick?
Yes. It definitely helped me with my personal experience with having about 5 operations. I think my cats and my dogs, they immediately know that something's not quite right with you, I think. And it is quite nice that they're just that companion and they'll be there for hugs if they need it, or they'll just lie next to you. And I remember I had a really, really big operation, and I was in hospital for about a month, and I was missing my dogs. I was missing my cats at the time and my family, because I was in hospital alone because my parents were working and my sisters were at school. And I remember I came home and immediately all 3 of my cats were around me. One was blocking the door, 2 were by me, and one of them was blocking my legs because both of them were in plaster. It's just like another human being there to give you a hug. They're not able to talk, but they show you affection in other ways. Like they'll even just looking at you or putting a paw on your hand. And I think it does help. I've never really thought of it being a negative thing, because even my crazy dogs now, I think if I came home and I had been in the hospital, I think immediately they would be like, oh, okay, she's not very well, so we need to protect her and we need to be calm. And I think they would do that. So I think it's a good thing, really.
And Sophie, I know you've obviously got 2 very beloved cats.
Yeah.
Do you find they give you consolation when things aren't so good, when you're not feeling so good?
Oh, definitely. Although sometimes I do feel like it's because when I'm away at university, my bed is their bed. And then they're like, oh, hold on, she's taking up the bed here. So they'll just come and sit on me. But there are sometimes when I am sick or I'm upset, and Eliza will come and like lay across my chest or like lay beside me. And I think, yeah, you're here to comfort me. Eliza also does this thing where if I'm sat on the sofa and I'm upset, she'll come and sit on the back of my neck. It used to be something she used to do when she was like really small. And it is a very comforting thing, definitely, because I went through a really hard time last year. And that's what she used to do when she used to... And I feel like now every time she gets that energy off me, she does it because she knows it will cheer me up.
I think it's nice. And I think animals certainly can detect and be emotional, can't they? They can be emotional to us. Wow. Well, thank you very much for joining me for this death chatter. And I'm hoping for future podcasts you're fully integrated and part of the team now.
Yes.
Up for that?
Definitely, yes.
Excellent. So that's death chatter for this month, and we'll have plenty more in the coming months.
Ah, there we go. That was recorded at St Mary's University in Twickenham. A good chimwag with our 2 newest Art of Dying Well contributors, Sophie Reed and Daniela Ballard. I reckon a bit of a necessary injection of youth and creativity into proceedings. Now, you may want to get in touch with us, get something off your chest, or maybe offer an idea or two for a future podcast. So here's how you can do so.
To let us know what you think, follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook using @artofdyingwell. Or you can check out our website, artofdyingwell.org.
There you go. Do please drop us a line if you feel compelled to do so. Right, let's finish, as we usually do, with...
The voice from the chaplain's chair.
Did you notice a little change there? We've tweaked it ever so slightly and made it the voice rather than the view from the chaplain's chair. Just seems a little bit more matter-of-fact, I suppose. Don't know what you make of that. Let us know. So, who's in the chair today?
My name is Father Philip Connor. I'm a Catholic priest up in Lancaster. For the past 5.5 years, I've had a dog called Bosco. He is named after St. John Bosco, another priest who found dogs a great gift to their ministry. I understand that St. John Bosco, when he was roaming around the slums of Turin, sometimes he was afraid of being set upon by thugs, and this enormous dog would appear at his side, who he called Grigio. Anyway, for me, Bosco has not only protects me and provides security for the presbytery, but he has played a very surprising role in my ministry. I think the first thing about dogs is that they have a capacity to break us out of ourselves. You know, sometimes we have a tendency to become a bit introverted, and especially when it comes to death, we can turn in on ourselves, and it can become a very dark place. And I find Bosco on a number of occasions has really come in just at the right moment and reconnected us to life. He's reconnected people who are suffering with bereavement to the wider world and helped them to look outwards. I remember coming out of the hospital on one terrible day, a family had just lost a little child, and everything had been done, and no one knew what to say. Everyone felt totally out of sorts and totally broken, in pieces, actually. And I'd just parked up just outside the hospital, and they all came outside. The sun was shining. And I opened up the boot of my car just to let the dog breathe a bit. And they all the family gathered around the back of the car. And I noticed just how the whole atmosphere was transformed by the presence of a dog. And people even began to laugh again. And those bonds of family, the bonds of communion, broke open. So that's the first thing. The second thing I think dogs are wonderful is that they're incredibly sensitive to human emotions. I find it extraordinary the way Bosco picks up on human pain. You know, whether it's a family coming into the presbytery to organise a loved one's funeral, or at the end of funeral itself, and there's many mourners outside the church, Bosco will find those who are in pain and just go and be with them. And for a dog who is normally completely hyperactive and loves playing football and running around and getting excited about everything in life, the marked contrast, you know, when he sees people suffering is extraordinary. The other thing I would say about the dog, just finally, sometimes I will take him into the hospice. I was a little bit afraid of doing this at first because I thought he might be a distraction and disrupt everything the nurses are doing. But actually, I think there's a lot of research now which shows that dogs have an enormously therapeutic role, actually. And again, connecting people who are suffering and sickness to life and to take them out of themselves. So a wonderful gift. And I really encourage, you know, other priests, you know, I always think every shepherd needs a sheepdog. And you can't go wrong. Really can't go wrong with a dog like Bosco.
Every shepherd needs a sheepdog. Nicely done. I love that, actually. A big thank you to Father Philip Connor and indeed Bosco the dog. In fact, I've actually got a picture of Bosco, so perhaps we'll post a picture up on our social media accounts. Art of Dying Well on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook, as we heard a little bit earlier. Right, that's it for this month. A big thank you to Daniela Dos Santos of the British Veterinary Association, to our newest contributors, Sophie Reed and Daniela Ballard. Yes, that's two Danielas on the same Art of Dying Well podcast, I think probably for the first time ever. And, of course, Father Philip and Bosco up in Lancashire. My final thanks, of course, goes to you, our wonderful listeners, for accompanying us through this rather long podcast this month, and we'll have something fresh and exciting for you very soon indeed. Take care.